Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah says the resistance group will remain vigilant until a maritime deal with Israel is officially announced. Nearly 300 rights organizations issue a joint statement urging international action to force Israel to stop administrative detention of Palestinians. Iran once again calls for peaceful settlement of differences between Armenia and Azerbaijan, saying it is opposed to any change in international borders in the region. Thank you very much for joining us. A top story this hour, the Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah says the resistance movement will stand by the government in its decision on the maritime deal with Israel.
We will remain vigilant until the government officially announces the deal has been signed. I know all the Lebanese people want this issue to end, but we need to keep vigilant since the other side might change their mind any moment.
Nasrallah once again warned the Israeli regime against looting Lebanon's natural resources. Lebanon's President Michel Aoun had earlier said he would hold consultations with political groups for a unified position before giving a go-ahead to the deal. The potential agreement with Israel seeks to settle Beirut's maritime dispute with the regime over a gas field in the Mediterranean. Earlier, the presidential office said the draft meets Lebanon's demands and protects its rights to natural wealth. It said the agreement will pave the way for Lebanon to explore offshore natural gas reserves. Our correspondent in Beirut, Mariam Saleh, recounts why the deal is significant for Lebanon, adding it's the first time Israel has succumbed to the demands of an Arab state.
We have three main issues here. Number one is that we have a deal. It's been very discreet, of course, but we know some details. We know that Lebanon will be given definitely 923, and Lebanon will also be given a potentially rich field called the Kana field, which goes beyond line 23. It's not just line 23, so we have something line 23 plus. In addition to that, we have assigned a confirmation from the United States that Lebanon may begin immediately to drill in its waters, and no one will come near that right, and no one will stop that right. So these are three very significant issues that we do know from sources, of course. This has been translated by a meeting today between Prime Minister Najib Mikati, the Energy Minister Fayyad, who met with representatives of the French petroleum company Total, and they have asked the company to begin directly to drill in Lebanese waters. So this is very significant for Lebanon. It is the first time, and as we hear from Israeli media, that this is the first time that the Israelis actually succumb to certain demands from a single Arab state and accept its demands for Line 23, which was something that we saw 11 years ago as almost impossible.
Nearly 300 rights groups have condemned the continued detention of Palestinians in Israeli prisons. In a joint statement, they called on the international community to act against the crimes of Israel. The 292 rights groups say Israel is currently holding around 4,700 Palestinian prisoners, including dozens of women, children, and people suffering from various illnesses. The statement said the detainees are being subjected to arbitrary arrest and torture, which are both violations of international law. The groups also censured Israel for its administrative detention of Palestinians, urging the international community to pressure the regime to end such imprisonments. The much-criticized policy allows Israel to imprison Palestinians for years without charge or trial. Palestinian gunmen have killed an Israeli soldier in the occupied West Bank as tensions remain high over the regime's deadly crackdown on an almost daily basis. The shooting took place near a settlement located between Nablus and Jenin. The Israeli military says searches are underway to find the gunmen who escaped in a car. A group called Den of Lions has claimed responsibility. Tensions have been running high across the occupied territories. On Sunday, another Israeli soldier was killed following the regime's overnight raid in the east of Al-Quds. Palestinian resistance movements have hailed the attacks, calling them a proper response to the regime's atrocities. More than 100 Palestinians have been killed by regime forces in the West Bank since the start of this year. Earlier, we spoke to our Ramallah correspondent, Mona Kandil. She told us about the operation that targeted this Israeli soldier. Let's take a listen.
What's happened is that a Palestinian vehicle stopped, and the men inside it, whether it's a man or a number of Palestinian men, opened fire at Israeli soldiers were stationing near the illegal settlement of Shavi Shamron, near the northern West Bank city of Nablus. An Israeli soldier was killed. The manhunt for this Palestinian vehicle and the men inside it are still ongoing. All the entrances to Nablus city had been completely closed. And we are speaking not only about Nablus city, but also the cities and towns northern the occupied West Bank are completely separated from the central of the occupied West Bank and southern the occupied West Bank. Israeli soldiers are conducting a manhunt up till the moment.
Iran says it is against geopolitical changes in the region or any action to alter international borders. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the comment in a meeting with the visiting head of the Armenian Parliamentary Friendship Group in Tehran. He said the Islamic Republic has a principled policy of respecting the national sovereignty and territorial integrity of other countries. Amir Abdullahian was referring to a border dispute between Azerbaijan and Armenia. The top diplomat called for a peaceful settlement of differences between Baku and Yerevan. Azerbaijan and Armenia have been engaged in a deadly border clash since May 2021. The conflict further escalated in September this year, resulting in the death of hundreds of people from both sides. The United States says it is speeding up the shipment of air defense systems to Ukraine. The announcement comes after President Joe Biden reiterated Washington's support for Kiev. The White House has approved sending Ukraine a total of 8 National Advanced Surface-to-Air Missile Systems. 2 of the systems are expected to be delivered sooner. On Monday, Biden pledged to Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to support the country's air defenses. The U.S. has provided nearly $17 billion worth of security assistance since Russia began its special military operation in late February. Officials in Moscow have time and again said such shipments will only add fuel to the fire of war and prolong it. The European Union has announced measures aimed at providing further support for Ukrainian refugees. This is while borders effectively remain closed to refugees from other parts of the world. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
The EU's Temporary Protection Directive has been specifically activated to help Ukrainian refugees. It means they are guaranteed housing, healthcare, education and welfare payments in any of the bloc's 27 member states.
I would like today to announce that the Temporary Protection Directive will continue to be in place at least until March 2024.
The European Commission has also launched a scheme to make it easier for millions of Ukrainians in the EU to find jobs. At the same time, thousands of refugees fleeing other conflict zones continue to sleep on the streets throughout the bloc. Also, as the cost of living crisis in the EU intensifies, activists say the bloc's own citizens are not receiving adequate support.
Nowadays we see that people can be homeless and have a job. There's in-work homelessness, but there's also groups that are higher risk of losing their job from one day to the next.
As the war in Ukraine continues, the EU is pondering a 9th round of sanctions against Russia. Moscow's ally Belarus is also very likely to be targeted for cooperating with Russia.
all these steps, especially by Belarusian regime, are against the will of the majority of the population and will be met with new and strong restrictive measures from the side of the European Union.
There have been renewed calls in the European Parliament for less focus on sanctions, less focus on arming Ukraine, and more focus on peace talks.
We need diplomats to finally take action. This is the view of 77% of all Germans. Political offers need to be made in order to encourage both sides to lay down their weapons.
According to many analysts, Western sanctions against Russia are clearly not working. Otherwise, a ninth package would not be on the agenda. In fact, economists say the current sanctions are hurting EU citizens far more than had been anticipated. Inflation and interest rates continue to rise with no clear end in sight. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Moving on now, fears are mounting in the UK over a new wave of austerity as the government unveils details of its strategy to boost the country's economy. Leading think tank Institute for Fiscal Studies says Britain faces, quote, big and painful cuts in public spending to put the country's finances on a sustainable path. The IFS said reducing debt through spending cuts alone risks stretching credibility to breaking point. Prime Minister Liz Truss has pledged to go ahead with the growth package after she was forced to drop a plan to cut taxes for the richest earners last month. Truss's intention has had the opposite effect, with the British pound crashing and the government's repayment on borrowing pushing up. Amina Taylor tells us more about the consequences of the austerity measures the UK government has taken so far and those it unveiled recently.
When the Institute for Fiscal Studies points to the fact that the British government will need to find 40 to 60 billion pounds to plug the shortfall, it's not going to come from the very wealthy. Again, it's going to be this further drive to carve out anything that's left in the public services. I mean, youth clubs, places around my neighborhood that were long thriving areas where young people could go or the elderly could hang out, all of those places have been cut. We're talking about almost ghost towns where they used to be thriving activities for those who were less well off. I'm not quite sure where the fat is left to be trimmed, quite frankly. We're already seeing a rundown of the National Health Service with record numbers of those still waiting for an operation. COVID pretty much decimated what was left in terms of, you know, waiting times and so on. Then you add that to what's inevitably going to be a cost of living crisis for the winter. I'm not quite sure where there's fat left to trim for this Chancellor. Where is he going to find more money to make more misery possible for the very poor? But unfortunately, the Tories have foam here. If there's more misery to be heaped on the poor, they will find a way to do that.
France's major trade union has threatened war against President Emmanuel Macron if his administration forces striking refinery staffs back to work. The warning from the General Confederation of Labour, or CGT Union, comes after the government threatened to intervene to end the weeks-long walkout that has caused fuel shortages in the country. Earlier, Finance Minister Bruno Le Maire said the government would not allow the blockades on refineries to last. He also threatened strikers with requisition measures if fuel depots were not reopened soon. The industrial action over pay dispute has taken 60% of French refining capacity offline. This has led to shortages in a third of gas stations nationwide. The walkout has worsened the energy crisis and inflation, as France is already reeling from the impact of the war in Ukraine. Tensions are escalating between the United States and Saudi Arabia after OPEC and other oil-producing countries announced output cuts. Washington says it is now re-evaluating its relationship with Riyadh. The White House National Security spokesman says President Joe Biden is willing to work with Congress on the future of Saudi relations. John Kirby says talks on the matter will start right away. Earlier, Senator Bob Menendez called the government to limit arms sales and military cooperation with Saudi Arabia. Three legislators have already introduced a bill to withdraw troops and missile systems from the kingdom. Riyadh has, however, defended its decision for oil production cuts, saying OPEC has a pivotal role in achieving balance and stability in global markets. We've talked to Scott Bennett, a former U.S. Army psychological warfare officer, about Saudi Arabia's options if its relations with the U.S. are damaged.
You know, I think this is a very interesting opportunity to, ironically, reset the relationship between Saudi Arabia, Russia, Iran, because with the U.S. becoming increasingly desperate and fanatical, frantic, and irrational, you have the opportunity for Iran to make overtures to Saudi Arabia and say, in this multipolar world that's developing, and with the U.S. Doubling down on its global, you know, war of hegemony, let Iran and Saudi Arabia use Russia as a middleman for settling some of the tensions and conflicts, so that Saudi Arabia feels it has the room to maneuver and perhaps set up a new political orientation towards the BRICS and Shanghai Development, Shanghai Cooperation Group. I think Iran and Russia have an opportunity to bring Saudi Arabia more into their orbit. And I think this is the effect that is going to also replicate in Europe as nations reject the terroristic war of empire that the globalists, led by Joe Biden and Ursula von Leyen and Liz Truss and Macron and all of the rest of these globalist types, as the real world, which is India, Iran, Russia, Saudi Arabia, Brazil, as all of these nations begin to recoagulate and form more of a multipolar front.
Well, those were the top stories for this hour. Thanks for joining us.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Experts have warned that excessive economic aid of the European Union to Ukraine will cause some financial crisis for the European Union and may even result in its disintegration. High inflation, energy crisis, and weak economic growth have made many economic experts to compare the current situation in Europe with the oil crisis of the 1970s. While European countries and the United States expect to defeat Russia in Ukraine war with sanctions policies, now they're caught in a severe economic crisis of their own. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The website of CNBC writes, Citi analysts said the euro area is at risk of a financial meltdown on the same scale as the crisis it suffered a decade ago. According to a report, Wall Street bank analysts have raised concerns about the violent bond market moves and the European government's plans to borrow vast sums of money. They say the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz's relief package, worth 200 billion euros and aimed at tackling soaring energy prices, may soften the coming recession, but also poses risk for Europe. Those risks relate to the question of how the package will be financed and what that could do to inflation, to Germany's sovereign bond yields, to the European Central Bank's benchmark rate, and to the borrowing plans of other euro nations that may do the same. Citing Britain's recent bond market meltdown after unfunded tax cuts by the government, Christian Schulz, deputy chief European economist at Citi, told CNBC, "The risk is that others may follow that example." Christian Schulz explained that Germany could afford any debt financing thanks to its low debt-to-GDP ratio and lower external funding needs, but the package could open a door for less fiscally prudent countries to want to borrow large amounts of money and issue new debt. That could potentially lead to trouble, like we have seen in Britain. Citi analysts forecast that German debt financing could force tighter European Central Bank policy, which could also send yields surging in the euro area. Christian Schulz warned, "The risk is that this same dynamic, as we have seen in Britain, evolves on the European continent as well." Meanwhile, data by Saxo Bank shows that a European Central Bank stress indicator for the Eurozone's financial system, which looks at tensions in bond, equity and money markets, has risen from below 0.1 at the start of the year to almost 0.5 now. During the Eurozone debt crisis in 2009-2010, the index exceeded 0.6. Russia Today explains more about the same story. European Central Bank Chief Christine Lagarde revealed recently that Europe is facing lower-than-expected economic growth as inflation continues to climb in Europe, explaining that the European Central Bank had raised interest rates by 0.75 basis points in an attempt to control soaring prices. Speaking before the European Parliament's Committee on Economic and Monetary Affairs recently, Christine Lagarde admitted that inflation remains far too high and is likely to stay above our target for an extended period of time. The former International Monetary Fund boss, Christine Lagarde, warned that the economic consequences for the euro area of Russia's conflict in Ukraine had spiraled further since June, a reference to Western sanctions on Russian oil and gas, which have sent fuel prices skyrocketing. She said, "The outlook is darkening." While the Eurozone's economy grew 0.8% in the second quarter of this year, Christine Lagarde said the European Central Bank expected activity to slow substantially over the rest of 2022, to a total of 3.1% over the year and a mere 0.9% for all of 2023. She claimed things would improve marginally in 2024, with economic growth projected at 1.9%. While noting a decline in global demand due to what she called the worsening terms of trade, Christine Lagarde said much of this quarter's economic growth was due to strong consumer spending driven by reopening of COVID-shuttered industries like tourism. She said high inflation is being reinforced by gas supply disruptions, adding that uncertainty and falling household and business confidence were also contributing to the bleak predictions. Inflation hit 9.1% in the month of August, driven by energy and food prices. The European Central Bank has hiked its inflation projections accordingly, setting 8.1% for 2022, 5.5% for 2023, and 2.3% for 2024, with Christine Lagarde pointing the finger again at major disruptions in energy supplies. The central bank's recent 0.75 percentage point interest rate increase earlier this month was only the second hike in 11 years, after it added 50 basis points in July. Christine Lagarde said the increase would dampen demand but ensure that inflation expectations remain well anchored. Lagarde admitted the situation is expected to get worse before it gets any better, with regard to high energy and high food costs, the most important issues for 2 out of 3 Europeans right now. However, she urged governments to make sure fiscal support for the most vulnerable households were temporary and targeted so as not to exacerbate inflationary pressures. Turkey's Anadolu news agency has more on the same story. The European Union Statistical Office warned recently over 95.4 million people, every fifth EU citizen, were at risk of poverty or social exclusion in 2021. According to the latest data revealed by Eurostat, 21.7% of the European bloc's population lived last year in a household that experiences at least one of the three main risks of poverty: severe social and material deprivation, or very low work intensity. The number is slightly higher compared to 2020, when 94.8 million people, representing 21.6% of the European Union's population, faced similar difficulties. The statement explained, in total, 73.7 million people in the European Union were at risk of poverty, while 27.0 million were severely, materially and socially deprived, and 29.3 million lived in a household with low work intensity. Some 5.9 million people, or 1.3% of the EU's population, simultaneously experienced all of the three risk factors. Among the 27 European Union member states, Romania has the highest share of the population, 34%, facing poverty and exclusion. This was followed by Bulgaria, with 32% of the population facing poverty and exclusion. Greece and Spain, both with 28% of their people at risk, were in third and fourth positions. Meanwhile, the Czech Republic, Slovenia and Finland recorded the lowest shares of the population in deprivation, with 11%, 13% and 14% respectively.
Food for thought.
Salam, and here are words of guidance from the Prophet of Islam that are food for thought for Islamic unity. On the resurrection day, no foot of a servant of Allah will move before being asked about four things: the years and how they were spent, the body and how it was used, the wealth and how it was earned and spent, and about love towards us, the Ahlul Bayt.
Thank you. Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, preventing the loss of other people's lives. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of preventing the loss of other people's lives. What do we mean by other people's lives is that sometimes, due to our own actions, our planning, our thoughts, the way we socialize with the people, we take people's time and they're wasting their life by spending that time with us. Maybe as a teacher, when I'm teaching, I'm taking the time of my class, and there I spend some time, some hours with my students, which is the waste of their life, and they're losing the time which they could spend in some other case or in some other things, which is better for them. Therefore, I must prevent the loss of other people's lives. I must prevent and not to allow myself to waste their lives in spending those hours with me if it is not useful. Therefore, it is very important. For example, as a speaker, when a speaker comes on a stage, he delivers a speech for 1 hour, but the people who are in front of them, maybe there are 10 people. So when you multiply 10 with 1 hour, it's 10 hours. I have taken 10 hours from the social life. These were the 10 useful hours. Did I give a message? Did I did something which was useful for them? Did they gain anything from the speaker when they were attending the speech of a specific person or not? Therefore, it is very important that we prevent the loss of the people's life. And if we can think about things like this, then obviously we are scheduling our life in a way that it is always useful for the others, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of preventing the loss of other people's lives. And we said that due to us, there might be some cases where the people's life are wasting, the people are wasting their life. Therefore, we should not do something and we should prevent from performing such actions, from performing such things. And I said that the better example is the example of a teacher or a speaker, that when they take time off the people, we need to see whether they are spending it as a useful time or not. For example, we can see our generations are deviated. It is only because that maybe in the house, parents are not attentive towards their kids. But on the other hand, there is a big burden on the shoulders of the teacher and the school and the university where they go and study. So when they're spending that time over there And if teacher is unable to train the kids, unable to provide the tarbiyah to the kids who are there for him, with him for 1 hour, maybe for 4 hours, or the school when they have these kids for 6 hours, less or even more, then what are they providing them? How they are training them? And this is very important that we should look at our life in this way. We know that Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayhi, he was the supreme leader of the Islamic Revolution, and therefore he had put specific time for a couple of things. For every single action, he had specific time, and he wasn't wasting the time. Even when he used to teach, there was a specific time, and after that, neither before that nor after that, he used to take time off the students. Even when he became the supreme leader for 9 to 10 years, when he was in Jamaran, he had a specific time that at the 10 o'clock, dot 10 o'clock, he used to start meeting people, and not even after that. So he wouldn't accept it if people were not coming, if those who were had appointment. So therefore, it is very important to be punctual and not to waste others' time so that they're not losing their life time, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/en/call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
News, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
Illegal hunting and hybridization with American crocodiles have for decades threatened their populations, with some species being on the verge of extinction. But there are some people who put their lives at risk to save the natural heritage. A Cuban researcher has released a baby crocodile that was confiscated from illegal hunters back into the wild. It was a happy moment for Etienne Perez, who went waist-deep in the dark water of Zapata Swamp to free Cuban crocs, the smallest known range of any living crocodile species. Cuban scientists were racing for quite some time to save the rarest crocodile. The government has protected virtually all of the vast swamp, widely considered to be the best preserved in the Caribbean. But the scientists say more efforts are needed to save the nature.
Releasing crocodiles seized from poachers is really impressive because we return the animal to a free life in the wild. In the case of the animals in the hatchery, we are trying to increase the historical range of the Cuban crocodile and, of course, increase the number of these individuals in the wild.
Cuban scientists estimate that around 4,000 crocodiles continue to live in the wild. But because the area they prefer within the wetland is relatively small, a climate-related disaster, increasingly common now globally, could wipe out the brunt of the population. They say illegal hunting for decades is also threatening crocodile populations.
Robots are slowly but surely becoming part of everyday life, taking on human roles in different areas. Now, fast food restaurants can make French fries faster and better as a robot called Flippy 2 takes over the job.
When an order comes in through the restaurant system, it automatically spits out the instructions to Flippy. It takes a frozen product, fries it for the precise amount of time and puts the finished product in the end. It does it faster, more accurately, more reliably, and happier than most humans do it.
Flippy 2 has been created in a robotic lab in California called MISO after 5 years of efforts by its developers. According to the project engineers, a really good understanding of the food science is needed to make sure the food quality is there, how different food sticks together, and how the temperature and heat affect it. The MISO CEO says the machine can cook several meals with different recipes simultaneously, removing the need for catering staff.
This technology utilizes a whole bunch of computer vision. There's cameras throughout the system, including right here we have these food identification cameras. The cameras not only guide the robot and tell it exactly where it is in space and how to move through this area, but also identifies the food type and it knows the recipe for each one.
The MISO CEO says tasks like the fry station are the kind that humans are most happy to afloat. The name Flippy comes from the original machine designed to flip burgers, which was not very useful for restaurants. On the outskirts of China's metropolis, Shanghai, a tiny island has been dubbed Cat Island as it provides shelter for stray animals. Since it opened last month, a charity based on the island is taking in cats mainly brought from Shanghai residents. These small carnivorous mammals are neutered and evaluated, and those with good temper and health are allowed to roam free on the island. The city's Stray Cats Management Center says their trap-neuter-release policy is to protect stray cats, limits their population, and maintain ecological balance. However, Shanghai has an estimated 200 stray cats per square kilometer, which means other methods will be needed to control the urban population, stray cats. A pair of baby panda twins make their debut appearance at the Chongqing Zoo in southwest China, with visitors flocking to cherish the abundance of cuteness.
Our returnee panda, Ershan, gave birth to the twin brother and sister on July 22nd this year. Currently, the elder brother weighs 4.3 grams and the younger sister weighs 0.6 grams. They're in good condition at present.
The twins' first public appearance was on Saturday, the first day of the week-long National Day holidays. During this week, the pair of giant panda cubs will be on display in the nursery of the panda house of the zoo. Their mother, Ershan, once lived in Canada as a goodwill envoy, but returned to her homeland in 2020. This was Ershan's second delivery of twins. A total of 21 pandas currently live in the Chongqing Zoo, which has been breeding giant pandas since the 1960s. The evolution of robots has been one of the fascinations of recent technological developments. And now the most cutting-edge achievements in that department were presented to the public during a conference in Beijing. The four-day annual World Robot Conference was held both offline and online. It featured three major events, including forum, expo, and competition. On display were more than 500 sets of robots from 130 companies from China and abroad. The conference gave an idea of how the future of humanity will be impacted by the automations. It shows how they can contribute to different sectors, from the restaurant industry and medicine to elderly care, agriculture, and manufacturing.
The light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields, like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
An aircraft powered by electricity may still be some way off, but one of its types is already here thanks to a whole range of innovative solutions being developed by aviation firms. American company Aviation Aircraft has debuted its all-electric plane in Washington State. The aircraft, named Alice, took off the runway at Grand County International Airport and flew for 8 minutes. It reached an altitude of 3,500 feet before touching down the ground. According to the company, the aircraft produces no carbon emissions, significantly reduces noise, and costs a fraction to operate compared to usual light jets. The company says it continues to develop and tweak the plane's battery system for an hour flight.
We're targeting a design criteria of 35 minutes for a charge. And so that'll be a charge for the typical route length. It's actually, as I just said, it's actually a design point. So going back to the comment I made earlier about designing batteries for aircraft, it's one of the considerations is how quickly do we want it to charge and how much power do you want to be able to draw from it. So again, we're targeting call it 30 minutes of charge for an hour of flight time or about 2C if you're...
The company aims to find its way into the market for trips that sit between 150 and 250 miles, a range that features aircraft similar in size to Alice. It will also be for both commuter and cargo flights. For aircraft manufacturers, this paradigm shift is driving fuel savings in flight and on the ground, reducing carbon footprints and NOx emissions while also improving reliability and cutting maintenance costs. Many people of the world are supported almost completely by animals because they live in areas unsuitable for animal husbandry. But these days, even some city dwellers are making their living out of animals, like a Virginia girl. Andrea Diaz quit her job at a restaurant and started to rent her pet alpacas to cheer up steer crazy Americans during the pandemic. Since the launch of her business in 2020, it has expanded from 2 to 14 alpacas. Interestingly, 5 with fluffy pets are regularly making a paid appearance at birthdays, weddings, restaurants, and offices. She charges a starting price of $95 per hour. Diaz says the best part is when there are kids' birthday parties, but even it's really a fun for the adults. She calls alpacas a good exposure because they attract people.
In most of its habitats, the heavily trafficked pangolin faces the biggest threat from humans. But in Taiwan, these gentle creatures are exposed to quite a different danger, feral dogs. In the island, a government policy has led to a surge in the population of feral dogs. The pangolins share most of their roaming area with the stray animals. Plus, these scaly animals cannot move as fast as their attackers. When faced with danger, pangolins curl themselves into a ball shape, but the tail still remains at the most outer side, and that's where the dogs hit them hard.
Ecuador's Galapagos National Park is testing different coral replanting methods in an effort to restore fragile underwater ecosystems around local islands.
These corals are important because they are recyclers in the ocean. They convert all the CO2 into oxygen. These corals are important because they are refuges, nurseries, and nursery areas for some fish species.
coral reef die-offs affect the marine food supply chains and are considered a major climate tipping point. The experimental project is run by park rangers and volunteers in a bay on Santa Cruz Island. Since 2020, they have tested how corals reproduce when they are placed on surfaces like bricks, cement, or tied together and strung on metal frames. They're growing samples in a nursery before adding them to bay. The rangers are reporting improvements with the appearance of new fish near the replanted corals.
A free climber known as the French Spider-Man scales a 48-story skyscraper in Paris to fulfill a goal he set for himself once he reached the age of 60.
A few years back, I promised myself that the day I turn 60, I have to climb the total tower. Because 60 years old marks retirement age in France, and so I thought this would make a very good nod.
Alain Roberts says this building is not as hard as others he has climbed. The French Spider-Man has ascended over 100 of the world's tallest buildings, including the Sydney Tower, the Sears Tower in Chicago, and the Burj Khalifa in Dubai, amongst many others. Roberts says he spent 2 decades climbing mountains before attempting urban climbs. Using his rock climbing experience, he sometimes carries a small bag of climbing chalk to help him grasp the small protrusions of building walls. Many of his climbs can last several hours. The 60-year-old daredevil says he wants to give people the message that age is a number and one can still be active and do sports. A Palestinian farmer has discovered an ancient Byzantine-era mosaic when preparing to plant an olive tree on his plot of land in the Gaza Strip. The farmer and his son have been carefully excavating the area for 3 months since spring. The pair dug out 3 patches, revealing glimpses of an ornate mosaic with intricate images of birds, flora and tile patterns. Its full size is roughly 23 square meters. The discovery has set off excitement amongst archaeologists. Experts say it is one of the most well-preserved specimens with precision in graphics and richness in colors. According to archaeologists, the mosaic pavement dates back to the 5th and 7th centuries. Last month, another Palestinian farmer found the rare stone sculpture while working on his land, which dates back to around 2500 BC.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A new study in the United States published in June in Health Affairs has found that counties with a Republican majority had a greater share of COVID deaths through to October of 2021 relative to majority Democratic counties. The study indicates that COVID death rates are higher among Republicans than Democrats. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The website msn.com has more on the story. For at least a year now, there has been strong but largely circumstantial evidence that right-wing anti-vaccine rhetoric was having deadly consequences in the United States. Despite early wide-scale access to COVID-19 vaccines, the US has outstripped its peer countries when it comes to the all-important measure of mortality, known as excess deaths. Meanwhile, US life expectancy has continued to drop dramatically due to the coronavirus, even as longevity measures have begun rebounding elsewhere. One seemingly obvious explanation for this grim piece of American exceptionalism is that Republicans, egged on by right-wing political and media elites, have been avoiding simple public health measures to protect themselves, like getting vaccinated, and dying at elevated rates as a result. This problem wasn't exactly hard to pick up on just by paying attention to social media or reading the news. But the story appeared to be borne out by more careful data analysis, too. Some of the key clues are: when it comes to the public's belief about the pandemic, such as whether there should be more or fewer COVID restrictions, the gap between left and right-leaning voters has been much higher in the United States than elsewhere. COVID cases and deaths are higher in more Republican counties. Republicans are more likely to believe misinformation about vaccines. Republicans are substantially less likely to get vaccinated. Researchers have found that exposure to conservative media, particularly to Fox News Channel, made people more vaccine hesitant. This body of evidence had some limitations, though. For instance, the fact that red counties tended to have higher death rates than blue counties might not mean that conservatives were more likely to die from COVID if lots of Democrats who happened to live in right-wing parts of the country were perishing too. Or, if more Republicans were dying, it might also be because they were different from Democrats in ways that affect COVID outcomes, but were not directly driven by ideology. They might just be older, in worse health, or in a community with poorer health resources, for example. Recently, however, a new working paper by three Yale University public health and economics researchers, Jacob Wallace, Paul Goldsmith Pinkham, and Jason Schwartz, is offering the most definitive and direct evidence I've seen yet, confirming that Republicans have indeed been more likely to die because of COVID. The study released by the National Bureau of Economic Research also confirms the scale of these deaths and points to the central role that vaccine hesitancy has likely played in the tragedy. Much prior work on this topic relied either on surveys of beliefs or evidence about vaccination rates and deaths at the county level. The new paper, in contrast, uses information from voter registration files in Florida and in Ohio to connect individual-level data under political affiliation and age of people who died during the coronavirus crisis. Using this information, it calculates and compares excess death rates of Republicans and Democrats in 2020 and 2021, meaning it looks at how many more people in each party died during the pandemic, above what you would ordinarily expect based on their demographics and historical trends. Because they're using a measure that takes the age of population into account, the researchers' results shouldn't be affected by the fact that Republicans tend to be a little older than Democrats. Technically, excess deaths measure how many additional people have passed away from all causes, rather than just COVID-19. But public health experts like to use them to track the virus's toll because causes of death aren't reported uniformly everywhere, and it avoids the issue of whether coronavirus fatalities are under-recorded in some places but not in others. In studies like this one, it also spares researchers the task of tracking down how each individual died, which isn't feasible. It's a standard and sound approach, unless